Thanks to both counsel, the case will be taken under advisement. And the second half of this case, United States versus Nathan Moore. Mr. Williams.
Morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Stephen Williams for the defendant, Nathan Moore, counsel. Your Honors, there's two parts to our argument here. The first one, which Mr. Krigo didn't discuss as much, which I would like to talk about at first, is the presumptive reasonableness that's attached to the guidelines. And this is relevant on review particularly. That is clear. I think since the time that we filed these briefs, it's become clear that this isn't just relevant on review. This is relevant at sentencing as well. Clearly, it's in the minds of the sentencing courts that sentences are going to be reviewed for reasonableness and a presumption is going to be attached to the guideline sentences. Recent figures released by the Sentencing Commission indicate that there has been little change. There has been some, but there has been little change in the amount of guideline sentencing that has occurred. This court has stated itself in the opinion of United States versus Cunningham that the point at which the presumption of reasonableness must be rebutted is at the sentencing hearing. So this presumption of reasonableness carries a lot of weight at every stage of the game. And the position, while recognizing that this court has dealt with this issue now on more than one occasion, the position that Mr. Moore advances is that there is no statutory there is no reason in construing the statute, rather, and there isn't any precedent for giving a presumption of reasonableness to the sentencing guidelines. The one and only factor, the one and only portion of the statute that assigned a particular weight to the guidelines is the one that was excised by Booker, where the mandatory guidelines were said to no longer exist. Certainly they still exist. Certainly the courts must take them into consideration. And as this court and others have stated, a proper calculation of the guidelines still must occur. But that being done, there isn't any support both in the Booker opinion and in the statute itself for affording a presumption of reasonableness to a sentence that falls within the guidelines. It is one of many factors that must be considered. Now, there is an additional factor. You could say, well, there's the proper calculation of guidelines and then there's sentencing policy statements, and that's true, but that's still just two factors amongst many which the court must consider in arriving at its sentence.
The majority of circuits have given a presumption of reasonableness to a guideline sentence.
That's absolutely true.
That's been our position, and until, I guess, the Supreme Court tells us differently, I assume that's the law that we're going to be following in this circuit.
And, Your Honor, I understand that. And, in this particular case, of course, we're advancing the argument for obvious reasons. So we don't think that there is authority under the statute for doing so.
You were in the Third Circuit, right?
Third Circuit, I think there's a few circuits where they haven't ruled on it yet as well, Your Honor. And so there's there are some places, or maybe this argument would be better placed, certainly, where there hasn't even been a ruling on it. But nevertheless, there does appear to be a conflict, and it's an issue that you could call it's a hot issue, and one that maybe we will get further guidance on. I know that I also advanced in the brief this issue of, well, does this approach a constitutional violation? And quite frankly, I have to admit, it is a difficult argument to articulate. And I think part of the problem with that is one must look at practice to see whether or not it becomes a constitutional violation. And since the time that this appeal was filed and the McKeetuck decision in this court, we have gotten a look at it. And it does appear that the guidelines are the tail wagging the dog still. And because of that, these concerns and the burden that is put upon the defendant at sentencing are relevant. Now, with respect to the other factors in this case, Mr. Moore's position is, like his wife's position, that it isn't that the court did not consider these at all. It is that they weren't given adequate consideration to the point, of course, that they would justify, or the court would see that these justify a lower sentence. And these include factors concerning personal circumstances, a history of abuse, a considerable degree of family responsibility with a young child, which the court clearly considered. That's obvious. It considered to the point and thought it was serious enough to stagger the sentences. But the problem still remains that even with a staggered sentence, if this issue is serious enough that one of the two defendants can be left out of prison, not be sent to prison for an additional 3 years in order to care for her child, if the mitigators are that strong, it is hard to understand, though, how it could also then be justified to then, at that point in time, when this child is 5 years old, that then it's appropriate to, at that point, send his mother to prison for another 2.5 years. So in looking at that alone, to some degree, the mere fact that it was considered and something was done, but what really should have been done is this should have been factored into the length of the sentence, because what's really at stake is the amount of time and exposure that this child will have to his parents.
So a 2-year unstaggered sentence would be preferable here.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
The children?
I believe it would be. I mean, there is the mere fact, or the fact of the matter is, at some point in time, he is going to have time away from his mother. She is going to be in prison. For a period of time, his father is going to be in prison. Now, with a staggered sentence, in addition to having that time and then switching caregivers, you've got that extended period of time where the family unit isn't together. So I'm not, again, the court thought about this factor, but when considering mitigation and how it's going to affect the child, I think it's clear in my mind that a lower sentence is the preferable way of recognizing this mitigating factor.
Are either or both of them in custody now?
They are both in custody at this time.
And when did they go into and were they remanded?
They were both allowed to self-report. And I can tell the court that ultimately the decision that was made was that they would go ahead and both begin to serve their time because of, after considering what the strain would be, that they decided that that would ultimately be the better thing for the family unit as a whole and for the child, which is the point I'm trying to make with respect to it. It's easy to look at it and say, well, the staggered sentence is one way of dealing with it, and it, to some degree and to a limited extent, that deals with one aspect of it, but not all of it. Mr. Moore also advances, amongst these other factors, the degree to which his criminal history, I believe, under the guidelines, overrepresents the actual seriousness of his prior criminal conduct. Most importantly, he's given 3 criminal history points for a DUI and being on court supervision for what was an ordinance violation at the time of this offense. As a consequence of that, he got the same number of criminal history points and is effectively sentenced in the same manner as if he had had a previous fraud case involving a lesser amount of money where he received a 13-month sentence. That's the effect of assigning those 3 points. That is an illustration of the mechanical workings of the guidelines and how the guidelines do not take into account individual circumstances. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Counsel.
May it please the Court.
Why didn't the government consolidate these appeals? This one in the last case.
Well, there were some different factual considerations in both of them. Not many, Your Honor. Granted, there are some allegations, for instance, with respect to sexual abuse and slightly different arguments. In retrospect, perhaps they could have been consolidated.
Yeah, I think they should have been.
They may still be.
But I'd like to address a few of the specific arguments that that were made by counsel for Mr. Moore. One of the arguments is that, that this is, let's talk with one of the last things addressed, that the applications of the guidelines is just a bit too mechanical, for instance, the three criminal history points. But then again, this is where post-Booker, there's a human element. The judge recognized that he was able to sentence outside the guidelines. He recognized it on a number of occasions, but could actually look, and without a mere mechanistic application of the guidelines, look at the reality of Mr. Moore's criminal history. In 1995, he had a felony theft from his employer, for which he received 3 years probation. In the DWI, ordinance violation or not, involved a high blood alcohol level, involved some dangerous driving, some speeding, and frankly, Mr. Moore was not to be committing any further crimes because he was on probation under a court supervision, in effect, at that time. So Judge Herndon could realistically look at it and say he doesn't have to apply guidelines mechanistically. But looking at Mr. Moore's case, there's simply no reason to go out from underneath the guidelines in terms of criminal history. Another specific complaint addressed by Mr. Moore is that Judge Herndon should have reduced his sentence based upon the past sexual abuse when he was a child. And one of the cases cited was Croxford, which I believe in the government's brief was pointed out to be highly distinguishable. And in Croxford, at least, the defendant in that case did have a psychological report, something which Mr. Moore did not have and did not request.
Now, this couple had a child that dies an infant in addition to this surviving child. Is that right?
That is correct. And the way both Mr. and Mrs. Moore brought that into play to some degree at sentencing is to suggest that this bore on the likelihood of reoffense. And the loss of a child is a terrible tragedy, which of course is going to have many effects on the lives of parents. But it was not obvious, manifestly obvious in any sense, how this would make either of the Moores less likely to reoffend. And again, there was no psychological report offered or even requested along these lines, and the argument is frankly not developed in any meaningful fashion. Now, for the time being, McKittiuk is good law, and the majority of circuits are finding that a presumption.
You're able to pronounce that. I always have trouble pronouncing.
That's how I thought when I saw McKittiuk.
I don't know if there's any right way of pronouncing.
Well.
You're a braver one than I am.
And with the presumption of reasonableness, which is attached, looking at the way Judge Herndon examined all of the factors, the sentence that he imposed is entitled to a presumption of reasonableness because it fell within the guidelines. But even looking at it, if you took away the guidelines and look at the careful way Judge Herndon addressed all of the factors, guidelines or not, this was an eminently reasonable sentence that should be upheld. Are there any questions, Your Honors?
Thank you.
Your Honors, just 2 points briefly. I think, and this is something pointed out in the reply brief, the Croxford opinion merely it stands for the proposition that this is a proper factor to consider, as are all the others. These family tragedies, these difficulties, they make the time harder. That's how it bears on reoffense. And when the family's having to deal with all of those things, as well as at this same time being torn apart by prison time, it just makes it that much harder. And I think it is a reasonable thing to consider. In this case, Mr. Moore had not ever done prison time before, and he received a very substantial sentence, one that we believe is unreasonable. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement. We move to the